This was recorded at the 17th Chinwag Live event, Micromedia Maze, in London on May 20th, 2008. Featuring on the panel Umar Haque of Havas Media Lab and Bubble Generation, media futurist Gert Leonhardt, Mitch McAllister of MySpace, Miles Lewis from Last FM, and Guardian Unlimited's Neil McIntosh, with Steve Bobrick chairing. The event was produced by Chinwag editor Deirdre Malloy. It was sponsored by DoubleClick and the UKTI.
Thank you. Okay, my name's Steve Bobrick, and I'm a sort of 15-year web veteran in the UK, and these days I'm doing advisory work in social media, digital strategy for lots of different UK businesses. Deirdre books me for these things because I'm free. So, but you get what you pay for, don't you? So, you know, you'll be able to judge. Now, we're going to talk about what Deirdre has handily named micromedia tonight. I'm going to ask for a hands up if you have any idea what that means. Oh, it's good. Unrepresentative, small handful of hands went up. None on the panel at all. So what I'm going to make sure we do tonight is by the time you leave, you'll all be putting your hands up because you'll all at least have an opinion about it, okay? I've been working in this business for so many years now, for 15 years on the web in the UK, and I'm so, you know, we're so accustomed in this business to working where, to an industry where change is always radical and everything is always huge or disruptive or damaging or massively positive. It's an industry driven by hyperbole. And I really wish one of these days I could just come and speak at an event where I could speak in more measured tones about, or rather, you know, I think I'll pick a different industry like fishing or something, somewhere where I don't have to just go on about the epic change, rate of change in the industry. So it would be nice if I could say something like, you know, tonight's session is about something kind of small and inconsequential and, you know, micromedia. It sounds small at least, doesn't it? You know, so we're dealing with a sort of an undramatic shift, something that's not, oh, I can't do all that. These guys are going to tell you about micromedia. And to introduce them, they're each going to give you 3 to 5 minutes of chat before we get started with the Q&A. I'm really going to invite you to participate as much as possible. Please, if you don't understand a concept or if you're really impatient with some obvious rubbish that's just been uttered, please put up your hand or shout out. It's really much more fun that way, and I know that Chinwag crowds have done that in the past, so please feel free to do that. Let's get started with the panel. We're going to start tonight with Gert Leonhardt. Gert's actually a musician by background. And in fact, in 1986, it says in his profile, he won the Quincy Jones Award.
I knew you were going to dig that up.
Yeah, no, it's in the profile. I'm interested to note, I'm going to learn a bit more about that later on, perhaps over drinks. I'm interested to know other winners of the Quincy Jones Award include Janet Jackson and R. Kelly. So there you are.
Good friends of mine.
That's right. Gert's also a music futurist of some note, and he's going to be telling you about that later on. Then we're going to move on to Miles Lewis, who heads up sales at MySpace Europe. Presumably there's another part of at Last FM Europe.
Close.
I had it so sorted out. And in 1992, he won the Teddy Prendergrass Award for a reason unknown. Mitch McAllister does work at MySpace, where he is product director. And he also won the Luther Vandross Award some years ago. Neil McIntosh is head of editorial development at Guardian Unlimited, the UK newspaper of that name, and he narrowly missed winning the Marvin Gaye Award a few years ago. And then to finish up, we've got Umar Haque, who is runs a strategy consultancy inside Havas Agency Group, and has never won anything. It's all very sad. So I'm going to start with Gert. I will remind you, this is a pub, so I really expect you to honour the centuries-old tradition of shouting and throwing bottles. I'm serious about in your intervention, though. We really do want to hear from you, both in the Q&A afterwards and, if you feel like it, during. So, Gert, over to you.
Wow, thanks. What a great intro. Anyway, let me tell you briefly what I do. I use the label futurist because I talk about the future a lot. Whatever that means. So I've been basically doing this for 10 years, mostly music, and the last 2 years in branding, marketing, film, and broadcasting. I wrote a book called The Future of Music, which is sadly enough 4 years old and still pretty much correct. Some of you may have read it. The new book is Music 2.0. This is my last music book. It can be downloaded for free or the Radiohead type pay what you like at music20book.com. And I will throw something now. Who wants a copy? I have one copy. There you go. A real printed copy almost hit you there. Okay, so anyway, so that's a brief introduction. So what I do these days, I advise companies who are working with technology and content. Anything that overlaps the use of music, films, motion pictures, radio, television, and technology. So I deal mostly with the issue of control. In fact, my next book is called The End of Control. So we're talking about, you know, how can you make money with content if distribution is essentially free? Everybody does what they want, copy stuff, remix stuff, send stuff, share, micro Twitter, by the way, G. Leonhardt on Twitter, if you want to add me. So what's really happening here is that social networks are becoming the next broadcasters. And think about this, for radio and television, it's a very scary message, right? The likes of Facebook and others are becoming essentially broadcasting institutions. And what we do on those networks is essentially bookmarking like a Google Reader, right? So basically, when you go to Google Reader, you add my feed, which is, of course, a must. In the future, you will be adding a feed for music. You'll be adding a feed for video. You'll be adding a feed for other kinds of digital media. And that essentially becomes your home page for media. So if you're now using Google Reader, imagine you had Google Reader for video, for audio, for text, for all kinds of information, database, software, games, and so on. That's what we're going to see in the future. And I would say that most companies in the future are going to be 90% syndicated. That means they don't have a central place where you find them. Because very few companies can afford the big brand that goes with a central place. I think we have two very good examples here, last of them, MySpace. I think they can afford to become a central brand in the likes of Viacom, or VH1, MTV. But I think most companies will syndicate their content widely across the web. Many people will never even go to the home destination. I think that's something we're seeing, especially in the mobile business, because there, you know, it will be fairly easy to have that bookmark on your mobile, on your television, on your computer, on your wristwatch, which is not a joke and not futuristic. Swatch has a watch where you can bookmark and read your emails and make phone calls right through the watch. And, of course, in Asia, we have places where you can walk by a shop window and it reads your radio frequency chip and displays different stuff in the window. Right? All these things are already here. So I think in terms of micromedia, what we're going to see in the future is essentially imagine a bookmark with all your information, some private, some public, some opted in, where all of your data and all of your media resides, like a tiny bookmark that is expandable. So that's sort of my prediction. Is that enough? Or you, do you want more? I mean, I can talk for the whole thing if you want.
Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead. Okay, good.
That's fine. That's good. That's okay, good. Brilliant. Thank you, Gert. And now we're going to hand over to Miles, who's going to tell us about Last.fm's use of micromedia create value in the music world. Video too, I guess.
Yes, thank you. And I've been at Last.fm for about 4 or 5 months. Previous to this, I was at Yahoo. And I have to say, everything Yahoo is on a big, big scale. So it's been a fantastic find to look at this company that has. It's very interesting what we're saying here. The homepage, for instance, only has 3% of traffic on Last.fm. It's a very, very small entry point. We are finding that of our users, we have quite a lot of them globally, that 40% of users are coming in via our widgets. We have 320 widgets, and none of them have been built by the Last.fm technical crew. They've all been built by the audience. And it's amazing to see that there's this big, big swell of developers. Now, I think from a point of view where Facebook is, I'm sure a lot of us in here are Facebook users. You've all got applications. And there is a lot of developers building Facebook widgets. The difference with us and the difference with more siloed and more verticals is the fact that obviously Last.fm is about music. That's all we are. We are about music. You listen to music on your iPod, it powers your profile. If you listen to music on the website on Last.fm, it powers your profile. Taking that music, that chaos of music, actually has become a social badge to a lot of our users. They then take that badge and put it on their Facebook page, put it on their MySpace page, and so on. So the fundamentals are that we're finding that a lot of people are accessing the service through Facebook or MySpace or Bebo or their blogs and not actually touching last.fm. And for us, we're embracing this. We're open up. We don't force people to come in wherever they want to. And when I was asked to talk about this, I was thinking, what the hell am I going to say? And suddenly, when I looked into it, I didn't realize to that point, we did some analysis, didn't realize that 40% of people come in via the widgets. So it's absolutely happening. And we're finding that we've embraced it. We're continuing to embrace it. When the iPhone launched, for instance, within 2 hours of iPhone being out, there was an application that you could download. We didn't build it, that someone out there built. And within a month, there was 2,000 users, which is amazing, because I think music is quite passionate for people. You think you're either into music or you're not, and I don't think there's any middle ground. So it is interesting for us. Moving on, how to monetize this. I'm sure a lot of you are going, right, okay, great, that's brilliant, but how are you going to monetize it? There's a lot of debate. I've been there 5 months, so I haven't got the answers yet, so I'm sorry. But there are a number of different elements that we are working on. And at the moment, Last.fm has no audio stream ads. So although we stream 300 songs a second, there is no audio ads in there. At what point will the audience bugger off somewhere else if we put ads in them? Don't know. So we're going to be trying a lot of different methods over the next 6 months from an ad-serving point of view digitally to work out whether it's possible to place audio ads in-stream to consumers in a typical radio way, but digitally. We think that by the end of this year, 55% of our users will be off-site through our widgets. So this is definitely happening. And one of our widgets has got 3 users, for instance. So it goes right from very, very small up to our biggest widget is 50,000. It's going to be interesting to see where it goes. And whether or not an advertiser wants to target those 3 people in classic hits of the 60s, I don't know. But we can sell them to them if they want to. But it's all about trying to find that happy medium, and we're going to be starting to work with agencies to work out if there's a model here or not. But as I say, I haven't got the answers at the moment. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Miles. And I'm already building a kind of queue of questions of my own here, so I hope that you're doing the same, because it's very, very intriguing to learn how Last.fm, the other businesses we're going to hear from, are coping with this interesting new terrain. Then we're going to move on to Mitch, who does work at MySpace, unlike Miles, who works at Last.fm. I must get that straight. And has a very intriguing sounding job site, the product director for MySpace across all of Europe.
That's right. Yeah.
Right. Okay, well, go.
Okay, cool. I've been with MySpace for a little over 3 years now. I moved here in the UK just 2 years ago to kind of help with the European expansion effort. And for me, it's been really exciting to see what's happened in that 3-year period of time. I think things that we were talking about 3 years ago that were theoretical, we're now finding that they're working, that the user is, you know, the end user is taking control. The users are leading the way into a world in which information is flowing more freely. And I think this is sort of the actualization of some of the stuff that Gerard and people like Lawrence Lessig and the open source community in general have been driving towards for a long time. That some of the creativity and the innovation that we saw in some of the early open source services that came out of those open systems paved the way for an entire industry of openness. And whether you're talking about the widget economy, or you're talking about open social standards, or if you're talking about data portability, all of these contribute to a more collaborative web. So it's not just about openness, it's about collaboration. And I mean, for us, that's what's really exciting, to see the web become more collaborative, more emergent, where the whole actually is greater than the sum of its parts, where we're all working together towards something that is truly great and beyond any individual or organization. And for me, I think it's happening really quickly. I remember just you know, a couple years ago, or 3 years ago, I guess, when we first started seeing the YouTube videos and widgets start popping up on our profiles. And at first, we weren't really sure what to think of it. But it happened like wildfire, and our users were rapidly adopting, you know, these YouTube video players. And we quickly learned that they were using it for personalization. They wanted their profiles to be more than just, you know, backgrounds and wallpapers, but to have content on them, to have something that represented them as individuals. And with the millions of people now flooding to use social networks, we find that individuality is really what's driving this this cooperation, this collaborative web. It helps make the web more useful to the individual. It makes content more meaningful. It makes these content associations more contextually accurate and relevant to them as individuals. And that's really, I think, for me, what's exciting. And I know that sounds dramatic, but it is. It's these little things, these little connections, which, you know, over millions of different connections actually makes the web even more interesting and more special. But it's not just the web either. I mean, we've all got phones in our pockets that are, you know, checking out websites and Twittering our hourly updates around the world instantly. And I mean, I think MySpace is not the only site out there that's reaching out to the operators and to the device manufacturers. And we're expecting to see in the future 50% of our traffic, you know, on mobile or non-PC devices. So for us, it's not about... Social networks aren't about walled gardens, or they shouldn't be anyways, but they should be about web services providing providing services for their users where they can go in and out and take their information and take control of the information that they're providing in this user-generated content. So that's it.
Thank you, Mitch. And now we're going to move on to Neil, who works at... just going to guess the oldest business on the panel by some distance, The Guardian. But he looks after development in the editorial area at Guardian Unlimited. Thank you, Neil.
Good evening, everyone. Yes, I work in the news business, which is always everyone's second favourite business or industry to give a shoeing to strategically. Possibly the record industry saving us from the very worst. But actually, in this particular world, I think we're reasonably well-placed in that many of us are actually, we're not channels where we just commission stuff and it goes through us and we reach an audience, but actually many of us are content creators. And it strikes me that in this world, actually, being a creator of content as well as a conduit to an audience, or maybe even majoring in being a content creator, is not a bad place to start. And that allows us to say, especially at The Guardian, where we're owned by a trust, our priorities are slightly different. A boss once said to me, the worst thing that can happen to a journalist is that you're ignored. Well, and that, if we're working to that particular principle, then you can say, actually, this whole explosion in social media and the ability to push things out to platforms to meet audiences where they are rather than expecting them to traipse to you, allowing them to customise the experience and what they hear about and all the rest is actually really good news indeed. Just nobody wants to be a channel. That's the key thing. Having said all that, we're only beginning to dip our toes in this particular world. Maybe doping our toes too, but not. I'm not talking about that. One or two issues for us, I'll keep this really brief, some of the things which maybe cause a problem in our particular business, and they relate to control. It's already been mentioned by other members of the panel. First of all, it's not just about our need to serve ads. That's obviously how we make our money. We serve ads against our content on our website. It becomes much harder to do that if you're having your stuff appearing in other people's websites, although we're working on ways, like Last.fm, with the Sound of Things, to serve ads dynamically into our audio, which is going really well. The audio is going really well. The ads come soon. And we already do that with our video, although we can't yet distribute that to other places. We're working on that too. So it's not just about ads. It's also about context and what surrounds your stuff. And the problem that arises when, if we have a brand that's built on trust and a degree, we need to be believed if we have any kind of role. What happens if we're presented in a context off our own site, which is which is one that we don't necessarily approve of, which our readers might find abhorrent. And the first thing we'd probably hear about is our readers writing to us to complain and say, how dare you allow this to happen? And they would perceive us as having allowed it to happen. So for the latter, for us, that latter point, that issue of control over context and the meaning that is generated by the stuff that surrounds the things we do is perhaps as important as all the commercial and other ideas, other problems that we've got. And it's back to the issue of control.
Thank you. We're going to finish now with Umair Haq, who I think many of you will know better because of his earlier incarnation as the man behind Bubble Generation, but tonight represents... well, I think you're going to have to explain to us exactly how you fit inside the Havas empire. So go ahead. Thank you.
Sure. Okay, well, thanks for having me, everyone. What do I do? I run the Havas Media Lab, which is a very small kind of think tank slash strategy consultancy sitting in the middle of Havas. So what do? We think about all of these gigantic issues that that we're discussing today, and we try and solve them. So what I want to do tonight is... is issue you guys a bit of a challenge. And the way that I'm going to do that is by telling you how I got to the Media Lab. So, you know, way back in the dark ages of like 2005 or something, I wrote this PowerPoint, which some of you may have seen, and it was grandly called, as Steve pointed out, it was grandly called The Age of Plasticity. And the fundamental point of this presentation was this idea of micromedia, and it was, you know, peppered with this word. And the point that I was trying to make was very simple, which is that when we break things down and we're able to remix them, the economic effect is that we get productivity and efficiency gains. Yeah, we get productivity and efficiency gains when we're able to remix things. Yeah? And this is what the idea or the ideal of micromedia is all about. That's where the value creation should come from. You know, that presentation went on to be read by quite a few people, and at the time I thought it was really cool, but, you know, I don't think I did a good enough job, because when I look at media today, I see an industry in turmoil, and it's fundamentally because of this issue of micromedia. And I think the real problem that's going on is that there's this promise of value creation. There's this promise of tremendous productivity and efficiency gains by getting micro. But we are not solving real problems. We are doing mostly useless things. And I will give you kind of an object lesson in that. We've got two guys here from Last.fm and MySpace who are guys that have solved real problems. But the problem that they've solved is the same problem, which is the music problem, right? So the music industry has sucked for forever. Right, and so these guys come along, and you could see it from a million miles away, right? That Last.fm and MySpace were going to totally revolutionize this incredibly shitty industry, right? So we do ourselves a disservice by speaking about widgets as mini games. We live in this sort of Facebook delusion, right? That widgets and micromedia are these meaningless little applications. The truth is, if you think about it, media is the stuff that glues the economy together. Okay? And where we are failing is that we are not doing that in any kind of meaningful or new way. Lately, I've been talking to a lot of investors, you know, and their big concern is the same concern as mine, which is that you look at the world today and we're kind of going to hell in a handbasket, okay? So food prices are spiking, yeah? There's a gigantic credit crunch, yeah? Income inequality is spiking. So you hear about China and India getting richer. The sort of nasty little secret is that it's only the rich in those countries that are getting richer. These are big problems, you know? You think about what percentage of the world still doesn't have access to good education or good health. And we're not solving them. Who is the first guy to take on the problem of health with the idea or the ideals, the principles of micromedia, as Mitch was talking about? It's Google, right? We all saw Google Health. And yeah, it may suck at the moment, but who else is in that space? And how many of us are sitting around coding mini games for Facebook? Which brings me to my last point, which is
You know who you are.
You know who you are. That's right. That's right. That's right. It's these guys in the front row here. Which brings me to my last point, which is that, you know, I'm sure we're going to get into it tonight, and I asked Steve before the thing, you know, what do you want us to discuss at the beginning? And he said, you know, discuss the business model question, discuss the monetization question. You know, I hate that goddamn word, monetization, for a very simple reason. You have to create some value before you can capture it. You have to have a purpose before you can profit. And we do not, in media today, we don't have a purpose. These guys had a purpose, yeah? The vast majority of the media industry today has lost its purpose in spades. So when we talk about this business model question, this idea that we can, you know, capture some kind of value by you know, shoving more shitty ads down people's throats, it's ridiculous. And frankly, it's just, you know, it's a waste of time for all of us. So my challenge to you is, you know, how do we remedy this situation and solve some of these problems? Thanks.
I knew it would be a good idea to put him at the end. Now, I'm going to start directly with you, Omer, because just before we go to the audience, because they're all kind of getting revved up with their questions. I can see them. I can see them just surging there. I want to know how this odd emerging business can help with world problems like spiking food prices.
Well, you know, I think, look, we, especially in London, labor under the delusion that media is entertainment, okay? And the truth is, in the age of the web, where everybody is glued to their sort of computer, you know, for upwards of 5 hours a day, media is a hell of a lot more than entertainment. So, you know, the traders in the city, when they see that stuff on their screen, is that media? Yeah, I think it's media. I think our problem is that we don't see that as media. Now, the stuff that they trade right now, the way that that medium is structured is going to cause a bubble in food, okay? So the bubble that started on the internet and shifted to easy credit and houses is now going to move to food, all right? And you ask yourself, what is the effect of a food bubble going to be? The effect of a food bubble is going to be to kill millions of people, okay? Because the poor can't afford food as it is. Yeah? So when the traders pile in and bid up the price of food because we're not thinking about, you know, hey, media is just entertainment and we're not thinking about a broader definition of media, I mean, and you ask yourself, why isn't a value getting created? That's fundamentally why, if that answers your question. It's a very bleak way to answer it. But
I don't know, it's good, and I feel properly chastened because I was going to talk about advertising and all that other stuff. But, you know, now, listen, let's go and see if we have some questions from the audience already. I know, actually, as a fallback, we have Gert, who wanted to say something. I know that because he had his hand up. Let's go to the audience first. Who has a question from the audience? And when the microphone gets to you, please, first of all, tell us your affiliation. Nothing.